Ladies and gentlemen, the chairman was more than a bit too kind. I am by no means equally qualified with Professor Cox to deal with the kinds of issues that Mr. Justice Clark will talk about tonight. I may, however, have more personal reasons for enjoying this opportunity, which I indeed do. I shall not recount for you the history of Justice Clark's career. It is in your program. I would like, however, to at least repeat briefly the highlights. Mr. Justice Clark entered federal public service, the Department of Justice, in 1937, and after some years became head of the criminal division, and then rose to the pinnacle of being Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Antitrust Division. Having reached that point, there was no place to go but down. But he didn't go too far down. He became Attorney General in 1945 and was appointed by President Truman to the Supreme Court in 1949, a position he graced with distinction for 18 years. The reason for his retirement was, I believe, unique in the history of the Supreme Court, but was, as Chief Justice Warren so well put it on the occasion of the ceremonies honoring Justice Clark on his retirement, a most felicitous reason, namely the appointment of his son Ramsey, another dedicated servant of the law and the public interest, as Attorney General of the United States. It occurred to me at the time that the occasion might have been made even more unique if I had been appointed as Justice Clark's successor. It would have been the first time, again, so far as I know, that a law clerk would have been appointed to succeed the justice for whom he worked. I thought it was a marvelous idea, but apparently nobody else thought so. Now, it was indeed my great good fortune to serve as law clerk to Mr. Justice Clark. It was one of the best years that I ever had. And I will repeat what I wrote a year ago in an issue of the Texas Law Review dedicated to Mr. Justice Clark. Those of us who were his clerks have for him only the highest affection and respect. Mr. Justice Clark is indeed one of the most genuinely warm-hearted persons I have ever known, constantly solicitous, not only of those for whom he worked, but everyone else besides. Now, that will account for affection. Our respect was aroused by his qualities as a judge. Now, I did not agree with all of the decisions that my friend made during the 1950 term. I might even say that one or two left me rather depressed. But I'm sure that every law clerk who has worked for any justice would say the same, and it's all beside the point. The point is that Mr. Justice Clark's positions on all cases that came before him were honestly and thoughtfully arrived at only after careful review of all that had gone before, only after careful consideration of the serious policy questions that were posed, and only after a trial lawyer's painstaking study of the record in each case, a characteristic which was for me a great education. I was rather inclined, I think, and people here attribute it to my Yale education, to be more policy than fact oriented. And many times, some of my best arguments were shattered by Mr. Justice Clark pointing out that there were certain facts in the record which made the argument impossible. Now, I would not be able to make a detailed scholarly assessment of the substantive aspects of Mr. Justice Clark's work on the court, for I have not, like many of my brethren, systematically studied Supreme Court opinions over the intervening years. But I am quite sure that I am familiar enough with what he has done to conclude that the admirable judicial temperament which I saw in an early year of his service persisted throughout, and that in consequence, his contribution to the work of the court and to the court as an institution was truly impressive. Open-minded, far more dispassionate than most of us are usually able to be, willing to re-examine positions earlier taken, he was a judge in the best sense of the word. And the country is fortunate that although retired as a justice of the Supreme Court, he is continuing to serve the law, justice, and the legal profession in all of the other manifold and important ways in which he has served so well in the past. Ladies and gentlemen, I am honored to present to you Mr. Justice Tom C. Clark.
Thank you, Professor Turner, and Mr. Stevens, and my fellow students. I feel like I am a fellow student. You know, the Supreme Court is an educational institution. It doesn't have any football team, but it does have law reviews to kick it around. It doesn't have any alumnus other than two presently, Justice Reed and myself. We're on the retired list. We have a half of alumni that's going to join us in June. we write books, but we study them too, just like you write a lot of things, and I'm sure study quite a few. When Don was there, we put out about two books a year. It's up to four now, Don. Even with Felix gone, unfortunately. I remember one year, Felix's dissent in the Sunday closing laws took one book. But don't get me wrong, I'm very fond of Justice Frankfurter. He was my next door neighbor when I was on the court. And he used to come bouncing in three or four times a day. He had more bounce per ounce than Pepsi Cola. And more ideas. And most of them were good. Now and then they'd be academic, but you could demolish them, and he was on good terms. A very friendly, lovable person, and highly seasoned in the law, and also in politics, no mean politician. I loved him, and he loved Harvard, and he loved the Supreme Court. Don, you're very kind in your introduction. I remember writing that. But I appreciate your reading it. In fact, you read it well. I had, retired justices only have one law clerk. So I've only had one this past year. But during my 18 years on the court, I had 37. One was drafted soon after he came to the court, and I appointed another one, so I had 37. So I've had now 39. I rank Don tops. He's only one that ever talked me into changing my mind. My wife said she'd been trying to do that for 44 years. And that was in Mids Filling Station, I think was the name of it. And I remember Don came out, he came on about July, I suppose. And we had passed this case over for re-argument. We had the opinion all written and was going to bring it down. And the Congress passed an act that made the opinion moot. And so we decided they'd sent the act down to the president for his signature. And we decided we would hold it up till the president signed it. Well, he didn't sign it. We adjourned in the meanwhile. So we just put it over for re-argument. The president vetoed the act. And so we had to have a re-argument. And during the summer, Don argued with me about several cases and things that were coming up. And being an old economics pro, this case is an antitrust case, and it involved economics more than it did law. And he convinced me that my vote was wrong, and so I voted the other way when on the re-argument, and the case came down the other way, and we just junked the first opinion. And so he has very persuasive powers. You know, tonight, the thing that pleased me the most was that he came so willingly, although he was number three. It reminds me of Adlai Stevenson. You know, he was invited one time to make a speech to the American bar. And before they'd invited him, they invited, well, it was Mr. Nixon. And Mr. Nixon, if you remember, got his hand caught in an automobile door. He was closing it. It was back about 8 or 10 years ago. And he was hurt himself and he couldn't come. And so they called Mr. Stevenson and he said he'd be glad to come. And so in his introduction to his speech, he said that his willingness to come reminded him of a story about this young lady who had strayed away from a straight and narrow path. And being a Catholic, she went to church and confessed one day. And after her confession, which was quite lurid, the pastor told her to go forth and sin no more. And he was hoping that he would not see her anymore. She was not one of his parishioners. But the next Sunday, it was his practice to always, after the sermon, to go down to the front door of the church and shake hands with the parishioners as they came out. And so he saw her coming down the aisle about four or five people away, and he began to think of something he might say, because he was afraid that she might say something untoward if he didn't get in charge of the conversation. And so as she came up, he stuck out his hand and he said, "Sister, I prayed for you for 2 hours last night." And she said, "Parson, you wasted your time. If you'd have called me up, I'd have come right over." So Don, all they had to do is call you up, and that pleases me very much. I thought tonight I might tell you, well, a few things that happened on the court, a few things that didn't, make up a few, and put a little spice into them. And you might be thinking up some dirty questions to ask me, if you have any questions. If not, I'll go on out and get the plane and go back to Washington. I thought I might give you an idea about, not how the Supreme Court works, but in between the cases, to give you an idea of how the judicial process works. You know, many people think that the Supreme Court just reaches out, sort of grabs a case over here, over there, somewhere, and writes her up, somewhat like old Miranda or Mapp or some case like that. Well, of course, as you know, the Supreme Court can't, if they found something that was bad in our life, in our economy, or in our community, there's nothing they could do about it. Unlike the Congress, that if they see something bad in our economics or in any type of our life, well, they could, within constitutional provisions, of course, pass a law. They can reach out and pass a law. But we have to wait until a justiciable issue comes to us. And so we can only pass a law, as some people think we do, after it's brought to us and gone through usually three state courts and sometimes two federal courts besides before it reaches us. And as a consequence, when it gets there, it's quite refined. But sometimes it triggers cases. It activates minds of lawyers as well as of litigants. And as a consequence, a rash of cases come. And the public gets the impression, well, the court is determined in this area, and they keep on writing opinions. When, as a matter of fact, we're trying to dodge opinions that are brought on by other cases. But being justiciable issues, well, we have to pass upon them. For example, let me tell you just the chronology of the criminal law revolution that's been going on ever since the time of Griffin in Illinois, which hasn't been too long, I think 1957, along in there. Griffin, you remember, did not have a transcript. And he said, in effect, to the Supreme Court, how could you expect a fellow to represent himself in an appellate case if he doesn't have a transcript? He doesn't know what went on against him. He was there, but he can't remember. He's not versed in the law. He hasn't tried any cases. How do you think that it's fair? I don't have any money. How do you think it's fair that I can't get a transcript, but if I had the money, I could get a transcript? And he talked the court into it. And we decided in that case that an indigent was entitled to a transcript of the record of his trial, and that the state had to pay for it, unless they could show that he could, by a bystander's bill, as we called it in the opinion, make up a record that was satisfactory to the court. Well, lawyers began to thinking then, as did some litigants, what's the good of having a record if you don't have a lawyer? At that time, we didn't require the appointment of lawyers, except in capital cases, which you'll remember began with Powell and Brown and that line of cases. And so the fellow who was convicted of a felony, he might get 99 years, maybe, but he wasn't entitled to a lawyer. Or he might be a 16-year-old child in some jurisdictions. He wouldn't be entitled to a lawyer if he had violated some statute to carry the punishment of a felony. And so they asked us the question, a very pointed question, I thought. And it came right in the heels of a year or so after. I speak of heels as being 2 or 3 years, because in the eyes of the court, well, we moved rather slowly. And 2 or 3 years is very fast. So on the heels of Griffin, along came cases that would say, well, don't you think it's a little horrendous? Here's a young man that is 15 years old, we'll say, 16, 17. And he's had a little history of mental disturbance. Perhaps he's been under treatment sometime somewhere. Perhaps he's been noticed among his friends as having some quirks. And he gets in trouble for the first time. He commits some horrendous offense. But he's not entitled to a lawyer. Don't you think you ought to carve out something from Betts and Brady that would take care of these unfortunate people who perhaps don't even know what they're doing, particularly these mentally disturbed? And we were affected by it. And you remember Lyra and that line of cases that we decided that, well, maybe we ought to have an appointment of case of counsel and some exceptions to the rule of Betts and Brady. Pretty soon the exception became the rule. And so along came Gideon. And Gideon said, as you well know, that counsel was required to be appointed in all felony cases. Now some ask me, well, what about misdemeanors? Well, the court hasn't definitely decided on that yet. I rather think if you've got them up against the wall, which you may be able to do in a year or so, well, they would say that counsel was required in misdemeanor cases. Because in some instances, the punishment of a misdemeanor may be just as burdensome to a man as would a felony punishment would to another. And so he too should be permitted to have counsel. And after all, as I pointed out in Gideon, the Constitution doesn't say anything about having counsel for capital cases only, or for felony cases only, or for misdemeanors only. It says that he's entitled to counsel. Prior to those cases, of course, that was meant that he could hire counsel if he wanted to. But I think you'll find that, as you've noted, I'm sure, in your studies, that three justices have already indicated that they would vote to require counsel in misdemeanor cases, and possibly that will be something that's coming on. Indeed, in Maryland and many other states, where misdemeanors are just as horrendous, just as carry just as much punishment as would a felony conviction. That's not to say that perhaps a traffic case might require the appointment of counsel. Well, after Gideon got his lawyer, incidentally, if you want to see a good film of Abe Fortas, someone asked me this afternoon about Justice Fortas, You should ask the Encyclopedia Britannica office to send over a film on Gideon. Justice Fortas is one of the actors in it. And Gideon is too. And so is the prosecutor. It's about a 20-minute color film, sort of a little documentary. And it's very well done. I'm sure they'd be glad to send it over for you to view it if you'd like to have it. If not, if you don't have an office here, you could write to Senator Benton, who's the president of the Encyclopedia Britannica, and he'd send it to you. I want to suggest that because you might get the thrill out of seeing these people in, well, not in real life, but at least as close to it as you can come to real life. Well, after Gideon, the people began to think, well, let's see, you said that we were entitled to a transcript, and now you say we're entitled to a lawyer. But when are we entitled to a lawyer? Just when are we entitled to a lawyer? You haven't told us that. Why, what good does a lawyer do you if I've already confessed? If I've already confessed, well, more than likely all the lawyers in Philadelphia, they're supposed to be the greatest. At least they charge the most. Why, they couldn't save me if I'd confessed in a fair confession that was not coerced. And so they argued with us that we should say when, and Escobedo came along. And you remember Escobedo, if you don't, everybody else does. And in an unfriendly way. I dissented, incidentally. So Escobedo said, well, just when am I entitled to counsel? And Justice Goldberg, you remember, said, you're entitled to counsel when the police officer focuses, F-O-C-U-S. I think maybe one of these cameramen would understand that. Nobody else did. I asked Abe, Goldberg, just what it meant, and he said, well, I really don't know. It depends on circumstances. It's sort of like asking Potter Stewart whenever anything's obscene. And he says, well, when it's hardcore. And I said, what's that? He says, well, I don't know, but I do when I see it. So Arthur, I think, he knows it when he sees it. But after all, the lawyers, they don't see those things the same way as justices do, fortunately. And so pretty soon I began to asking questions about, well, what do you mean by focus anyway? And so along came old Miranda. And Miranda said, well, you know, a lot of things happen in the jailhouse. A lot of things you don't know about. And perhaps you've read some of these manuals. And he got a stack of manuals about that high that I doubt if any police department ever used. But anyway, they had them in their library. And so he argued from them that we should have some system that might protect the man that had never been in trouble and never been in the toils of the law, as they say, and therefore would be a novice at it, and who was overcome sometimes by the just mere presence of the law. I mean by that the police. And therefore he should have some words of understanding that he might know or be told what his rights were. And so the court fashioned the four warnings that you know in Miranda. Of course, three of those warnings were old stuff. With the FBI, and the last one, number four, had been in their category for 2 years, ever since the 1964 Criminal Justice Act. However, those four warnings became the law, unless the Omnibus Crime Bill repealed it, which is doubtful. However, the four warnings are still used. I was out in Portland the other day, and this young man came up to the head table and handed me his card. And it said, John Doakes, District Attorney. And I shook out my hand and said, I'm glad to see you, Mr. Attorney. And he said, well, look on the other side. And I did, and it had the four warnings of Miranda on it. He said he passed them out to the police and told them just to give them to the suspect and have him read them. And the forewarnings, as you know, are that you don't have to say anything. If you do say anything, I'll use it against you. And if you're entitled to counsel, if you want counsel. And the final one, that if you don't have the money to employ counsel, I'll request the court to employ counsel for you, to appoint counsel for you. Well, of course, that was a momentous decision. And one that, contrary to most decisions, the court can't really cover things in a broad sweep like a statute can. The Congress can see this is wrong and this, perhaps this is better, so we'll self-peddle that, this is wrong, and they can write a statute that fits all these little nuances and these ups and downs. But the court, it strikes down. And when it strikes down, it sometimes works pretty burdensome. And in this opinion, however, I thought that the, although I dissented in it, I thought that the court fashioned in pretty understandable way, in language, these four warnings. Well, of course, there was a horrendous cry coming mostly from the constabulary that said that this tied their hands and caused a crime wave. Well, of course, that's absurd. If you study the crime statistics, why, the crime statistics are really not in the area at all that involves this particular matter. The FBI, as a matter of fact, says that their convictions are just as high as they were before Miranda was ever thought of, and that the number of confessions, percentage-wise, is just as broad as it was prior to Miranda. And in the area of state cases, if you study the index crime statistics, as they're called, well, you'll find that over half the crime is in the area of crimes against property, they call it. And in that area, why, most of it, unfortunately, is committed by juveniles. And age 13 commits more crime than any other age, even mine, which is 69, or yours is 18, they'll say. And numbers age 16 is next, and age 17 is next, so it's really right in that area where I'm sure Miranda would have no effect at all. Why, it's where we have to spend our time in trying to wipe out, if it's possible, the crime wave. However, you're going to find that there's much more to crime than just prosecution. I'm an old persecutor myself. I was an assistant district attorney back before you were born. And then I was later in the Department of Justice, head of the criminal division, after I was in antitrust, and after that, attorney general. And so I've had my share of prosecutions. And I prosecuted some before courts-martial. Indeed, I prosecuted two of the German spies that came over here and landed right up here, as a matter of fact, up at Kittery, Maine, and came into Boston. One was an American. He lived down here in Rhode Island. Cases that they brought to my attention, just the causes, you might say, the causes. And it's hard to determine, but the causes, as you can best determine, of crime, just what causes a person to do that. Now, here's a man that went to Farragut Academy, one of the oldest academies in our country. And still, he turned against his own country. Caught the grips home, went to Spain, went into Berlin, was trained for the underground, used all the indelible inks and all sorts of things, was given money to come back over here, came along with a German in a submarine, was put off the shore up here at Maine, came ashore in a rubber boat, walked down the roadway, caught him a ride, came into Boston, stayed here. He lived down the road. He stayed here for a while. As a matter of fact, he went to MIT for a while. And then he went on down. He and Gimple went on down to New York. Gimple was supposed to set up a little crystal set, send back short waves to Hitler, tell him what is going on over here. Well, they had a lot of money, and about $60,000 in American money, and they went down, deposited that in one of these boxes where you put your handbag or your briefcase down at the terminal station in New York, Grand Central. And they found out that they had to pay a dime at that time, every day. And so they then moved it up to their apartment. They had a little roof apartment, attic apartment. And they commenced to falling out with one another. One liked the high life, and so they would take $2,000 or $3,000 out of the kitty and give it to one another to have a little fun. And before long, the American decided he was going to run away with all the money. So he takes the briefcase and goes down to the terminal, and he decides so before he goes away that he's going to have one last fling in New York. So he checks the briefcase. Well, when the German came back to the apartment and the American was gone and the money was gone, he goes running down. He doesn't speak English. He goes running down to the same place that they'd been keeping the money. And he paced up and down and paced up and down, thinking maybe he might meet the American, because he knew he lived on a train that came into the Grand Central. And he just happened to notice, just through pure coincidence, this briefcase stacked away there in this check-in booth, where in the wintertime they have these glass windows around it. And so he waited till about 5 minutes before 12 when they closed up, and he went running up and made out he was trying to find his ticket for the briefcase, and he couldn't find it. And the fellow said, "Could you identify it?" And, "Yeah, that's it right over there." And they said, "Well, you'll have to tell me what's in it." So he brought it up to the counter, and he said, "Well, there's a lack of camera in it, and a sort of a light brown folder." That's where the money was. And the man opened it up, and there was a lack of camera. So he gave it to him. Well, when old Colpo came back, the American, to get his money, it was gone. Well, he liked to went through the floor. But the upshot of it was they both got the death penalty, and Mr. Truman commuted both of them. And one of them is still in the penitentiary. The other one's gone back to Germany. Now, what causes those things like that? I ask you, because I really don't know, but I know it's more than prosecution. I know it's more than parole and probation and the fact that I might give a 5-year sentence and you sitting in another jurisdiction on the same offense might give a 10-year sentence if that was permissible under the statute. That doesn't cause it. That might be have some little thing to do with it, perhaps, after I went to the penitentiary and you went to the penitentiary and you got 10 years and I got 5. We sat in the same cell. Well, of course, when we talked things over and we found out that I got 5 and you got 10, you'd say, "Well, justice is unfair. It's unfair. It's unfair to me because it gave me twice as much as it did you for the same offense." And of course, those are things that we must straighten out in justice. But after all, that's not the thing that causes crime. That one thing, that crime is already committed before that ever occurred. No, there's something else. And we have to find those things. Perhaps it's in the ghettos. Perhaps it's in other things. Perhaps it's in our fact that we have ourselves neglected these situations. But those are things that we will have to, it'll take a long time, that we'll have to study. In the meanwhile, we must try as best we can to improve what we do have charge of, and that is our prosecutive functions and our criminal justice. And we must improve it as much as we can. But I say to you that no civilization in all of history has made the improvements in criminal justice that this country has made in the last 15 years. Now, they have made it, it's caused some pains, it's still causing some hoorahs, and perhaps there'll be some attempted corrections, as they're called. But I think you'll find in the final analysis that the American people are going to say that so long as someone else is deprived of justice, I am deprived of justice. I am deprived of justice. And so long as someone else is deprived of the provisions and protections of the Fifth Amendment or the First Amendment or the Sixth Amendment or any other amendment, I too am deprived of that, or I shall be deprived of it some night the knock may come to my door. And if I don't have these protections, I may not be able to prove my innocence. And those are things that people should remember when they hear this talk about changing the Fifth Amendment, or changing the First Amendment, or things of that kind. We have lived with these things now for 180 years. They haven't proven too bad. Our prosecutions have been just about the same. I heard Hugo Black the other night say that they were written so that it would be more difficult to obtain convictions. And of course it would be more difficult to obtain convictions if you did not permit into evidence a confession that was forced out of a man by hitting him over the head with a crowbar. Of course it's going to be more difficult to obtain them. But that's not our system. The trouble with the thing is that the police heretofore, when they would get a confession, they'd drop the investigation. They'd go no further. They decided, well, we have a confession, there's no use to trace this case anymore. After all, we have thousands of cases. Only 25% of them are solved. We have to get busy and solve those. And so when the case comes up for trial and the confession is knocked out because it was coerced, the trail's cold. The trail's cold. And so they can't pick it up. But what Miranda will do, I believe, and other cases of that type, is to force police officers to continue to investigate the case until they're dead certain, until they have witnesses that they can prove, other than the confession, that it happened, just as they allege. But this is not the only field that the court has made momentous gains in, taking the field of civil rights. I know of no area in which a court has moved so far in such a short period of time. It's true that we moved very slowly before that time. Oh, it took us, they celebrated the 100th anniversary.